through Lakota culture, I was able to understand, like, oh, okay, like, we're supposed to be in a relationship with nature. And if you had a relationship with a human being and where all you did was take from them, that relationship wouldn't last.
You're listening to Faux Real, and I'm your host, Dawn Borchardt. On this podcast, I'll be welcoming the most diverse and distinct voices in indie film for revealing conversations about craft, inspiration, and the social role of cinema in the 21st century. So on July 24th, which is today if you're listening to this episode, the first day it comes out, is Pioneer Day in Utah. So most of you guys know that I live in Salt Lake City, so this is all around me. It's very odd to me. It kind of feels like culture shock. But Pioneer Day is a day that the state celebrates colonization from white Mormon settlers into the state of Utah. And Utah was and still is the home of the Diné, Hopi, Goshute, Paiute, Pueblo, Shoshone, Timpanogos, and Ute people. Living in a place that celebrates this holiday, it's basically as big as the 4th of July here. They have fireworks shows, fairs, parades, all that jazz. But having a holiday where people around me are celebrating that is very unsettling and uncomfortable. So I thought it would be good to have an episode out to sort of counteract that energy around the state of Utah right now, positivity out there from Native voices. So I really hope you guys enjoy this episode. It's with filmmaker Connor Ryan for his film Spirit of the Peaks.
Hi, I'm Connor Ryan. And I'm a Lakota professional skier and filmmaker, and I made the film Spirit of the Peaks with our incredible team of folks. And it is the film that follows my journey as a Lakota who skis primarily in Colorado on the territory of Ute people. And it's me learning what's beyond a land acknowledgement and using my way of learning as an indigenous person to learn from the Ute tribe to inform my skiing and my adventures outside.
We met because I actually, for once in my life, woke up early for an 8 a.m. coffee talk panel in Telluride. I was very excited. It was called Native Voices, the Intersection of Mountain Sports, Filmmaking, and Environmental Advocacy. It was really cool to see you, and you were like, I was really honed in on everything that you were saying, so I was happy to have you on the podcast. Going into the film, so in the beginning of the film, it kind of starts off with you talking about having a disconnect with your culture and then a reconnection, and I love that that's part of the film. I feel like that's something that a lot of people our age are going through, whether or not we were completely disconnected or not. But like so many of our relatives have been forcibly disconnected, and it seems like our generation is one that's really like making very conscious efforts to like connect with each other and connect back to our culture and the land. But can you talk about like what prompted that reconnection for you and what that process was like?
Yeah, for me, it's interesting because it started about the same time in my life that I started skiing again. I skied as like a kid, and then I took it up again at 20, 21 or so. Yeah, I think like both urges kind of came from the same place, which is that like I grew up with this understanding of being Native, but I didn't have a cultural connection. You know, I lived like the rest of my family for the most part was white folks, and my mom and I were the only Native people that I knew for like a lot of my life. At 21 was kind of where like I really started to find my own personal sovereignty and like really be like, oh, like my life has meaning and I need to go do something with it. And so that took me to the Black Hills for the first time, up to South Dakota, to my traditional homelands. And when I was there, I met the right folks by, I don't know, like pure circumstance. But it was an amazing thing that I got connected with some activist folks there because that was something that really appealed to me. And it turned out that they were based in Boulder, where I live. Oh. And there's like a pretty strong Lakota community in Denver and Boulder and the surrounding areas. because it was a big relocation city. And so I was just really lucky to find the right people in going back home who actually like were from where I was from as well. I mean, it's not super far between Denver and South Dakota, but yeah. And so for me, I kind of had this parallel in life of like, I'd been separated from experiences in the outdoors for, I don't know, maybe like a decade. I had a lot as a little kid. And then in high school, I did sports and things and didn't have the same opportunity to be outside. And so simultaneously, I was going to Sweat Lodge on the weekends and getting that understanding of nature. And through skiing at the same time, I was gaining this like personal connection to the places and relationship to the places that I'd never had. And so, you know, having experiences back then of like, you know, learning like water is life from being in Sweat Lodge and having an understanding of that and going and filling my bucket at the creek to bring it back over to the lodge and being like, oh wow, like this, if I trace that creek right back up, it would go to the ski area that I've been skiing at. And so it was kind of the first time I was able to like build a holistic kind of worldview and understanding of myself. And I owe so much of that at the same time to like first having those ideas of like Maniwichoni, water is life, Mitakayasen, like all my relations. And so it was a really nice set of parallels for me. And I was really grateful to the uncles and stuff who took me in and really like kind of held me accountable to be like, okay, you're going to be not just going to be here and learn this, but like you're coming early and you're chopping the wood and you're going to make an investment in this community. And so that was a really awesome thing for me. And it was like a scary thing at first to go back up there and be like, yeah, I don't know anybody or anything, but like I grew up with a, you know, understanding from my mom of like, we're from the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. And it's like I say in the movie, like, I didn't even know to call myself Lakota. I grew up calling myself Sioux my whole life. And so I was so grateful to those folks who were compassionate of that at the same time. And then also were holding me accountable of like, okay, well then that means you have to learn and you have to show up.
Has that reconnection changed your relationship with your mom and her connection to her culture?
Yeah, it's been a really tricky thing with my mom because there's a lot more trauma there in the older generations. And I think that's like part of the beautiful thing about our generation in this time is like for a lot of us, like we aren't the ones who went to boarding schools or it wasn't our parents directly who went to boarding school. And so that was the thing for my mom is her father got taken by the boarding schools at a very young age and she had no cultural connection to give to her. And because of experiencing that amount of trauma in his life from going to boarding school to then he fought in World War II and was a prisoner of war in a Japanese POW camp. Wow. and all these things. And you can imagine the kind of traumas you're gonna perpetuate if you've experienced that kind of trauma, especially as a man in the 1940s and 50s and things. Like there wasn't mental health support, especially for an indigenous man back then, you know? And so, for her, it was like a rift in a lot of ways. And so I think there's a lot of empowerment that she's gained by seeing me get to have like a healthy and beautiful relationship to that, as opposed to being like, oh, the reason, you know, like that X, Y, and Z happened to me in life is because I'm Native. The reason I was the only, you know, brown girl in school was because, you know, and like a lot of those things that I think like sometimes there's like a, I don't know, like a bit of like mystery around why trauma happens to us. There's never like a good explanation of that. And so I think in some ways, like the healing gives the trauma like a purpose and an escape and an outlet. And I think for her to get to see that through me and then get to see what I've been able to do in making films or whether it's starting, you know, the scholarship programs that we've started for Indigenous folks to get out and ski, like things like that. I think that's a really beautiful thing because for her, she didn't have some of the same opportunities that I have. She grew up in Los Angeles and Dallas, and that's not an easy place to be. Lakota is not an easy place to reclaim your culture, but you know, she was able to move me and give me a good life in Denver and Boulder area, where I was a little closer to home and able to have those experiences. And so I think like that joy that I get to have and that work that I get to do, like, I understand that it's because I'm standing on her shoulders. And I think that's a beautiful thing, that like that intergenerational trauma can quickly be changed into like an intergenerational pride. And that's a beautiful thing to have been able to experience throughout my life.
Yeah, I'm excited by all of the things that are happening right now with our generation and how much all of these things are getting spoken about publicly and getting representation on screen and through music and all this stuff. Like, I feel hopeful in a lot of ways, not entirely in other ways, but like not as much in an environmental sense, but I'm excited about the amount of reconnection that's happening with our generation and how much like hope that gives for like the next generation and our parents and grandparents.
Yeah, absolutely.
The biggest thing I think that I took away from the film and also hearing you speak in Telluride was this notion of reciprocity and our relationship with the land, whether that's the land that our ancestors came from or the land of other tribes. And I was wondering if you could talk about what like that relationship and that reciprocity means for you, like what it means and what it means for you specifically too.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think for me, like the origin of understanding it really comes from seeing what exists in the void, in the lack of reciprocity that we have in the settler colonial society that we live in. And so much longer than I understood my own culture, I've understood that there was this void and this rift. And that's something growing up where I've always been like, man, I would see people balancing a checkbook or paying taxes or like all these complicated things of this capitalist world and being like, there's just something weird. There's something not right about this. And then growing up, you know, in this day and age for our generation, like you've really watched like the climate catastrophe thing going from like this hypothetical presentation you saw in eighth grade of like, look out, global warming might happen, we have to do something, to watching it unfold in front of our eyes, you know, like watching the city of Boulder flood when I was like a couple years out of high school, watching it burn last year, like all these things. And so you can identify like, oh, there's something that we're doing wrong with our connection with nature. And through Lakota culture, like I was able to understand like, oh, okay, like we're supposed to be in a relationship with nature, right? And if you had a relationship with a human being, right, and where all you did was take from them, that relationship wouldn't last. It would become dramatic and traumatic, and it's not a loving relationship, right? And all of us can very easily identify like, oh yeah, to have a loving relationship with a person, you do some stuff for them, they do stuff for you, you get through these hard times by relying on one another. And I think that's the absence of, you know, that is what's created this void and this trauma in our world, is the fact that like we take, and we have a capitalist society where like the very definition of what capital is to take some relationship or some, you know, material thing in nature that you perceive as not having any sort of value or spirit, and you turn it in to capital, you turn it into money, you mine a mountain, and as you strip mine it, the mountain goes away and you build up this number in a bank account somewhere, right? And so that's what we've done, and we've taken so much as a collective, as settler colonial culture that many of us don't have an option but to participate in, right? We've taken so much and we haven't given anything back. And so when we look at like traditional ecological practices that come from indigenous cultures, it's all about like, okay, you don't take more than you need. And in the process of how we harvest this thing, it spreads its seeds. And when we burn the undergrowth of this forest to move a herd of animals so that we can hunt some of them, it allows the forest to then be more fire resilient over time, because the small fire we set clears the brush but allows the tall trees to grow. Those trees and then, you know, produce the fruits. And like, we were a part of this web of an ecosystem, and we're really one of the only members of the ecosystem that has been able to exit that cycle of reciprocity, right? Like, if you're a buffalo, you poop on the prairie and you have a perfectly shaped hoof to push your own poop that you just stepped in back into the ground, and it sinks in a little deeper than it would have otherwise, and you just tilled up the prairie and fertilized it, right? And so like, by nature of how things develop ecologically, they develop in relationship to one another. And the way we see the world now has caused us to step out of that relationship. And so for me, it was a big realization that even as a skier, I could be in an extractive relationship with a place where I'm not doing as much for it as it's doing for me. And skiing is what motivates so much of my life and gives me so much joy and makes me who I am, that I realize, okay, like, that means that also then who I am has to be speaking up for these mountains and these places and for the people who have the specific practices to the places that I love. I need to empower their voice, because it's their traditional ecological knowledge that's tied to the exact ecosystems that they lived in relationship with. And so that was the impetus of this film for me, was like to just figure out, how do I do that for you folks?
What are some things that you recommend for non-native people who are skiing or hiking, camping, doing anything? I mean, that's just recreational, but doing anything that's like in relationship with the land to want to make some sort of impact or have this concept of reciprocity like implemented in their daily lives?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the best places to start is like with personal education. For me, I think like one of the books that reaches the most people, if you're gonna personally educate yourself on these sort of things, is Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. And it's a super popular book for a lot of reasons, but she exactly examines, she's Potawatomi, and she's a professor of biology. And so she kind of marries these concepts in a way that I think, like, if you have a scientific background, you can understand how traditional ecological knowledge works and why it's beneficial to environments. And so I think that's a great first step, is like, most of us don't even understand at a fundamental level like what humans' role in an ecosystem should be. So I think that's a really important place to start. And the other thing that I would say is, like, you know, it's one of those times where I think, like, for a lot of people, it needs to be about empowering indigenous communities where you're at and figuring out how to do that. And there's a lot of ways that it varies, but there's also a lot of ways that it's the same, like getting involved like with a lot of tribal governments will have a page on their website for the tribal government or whatever about what their ongoing practices are, and finding ways to support that. I think that's a key thing, and advocating for the return and the co-management of lands by indigenous people, like the model that just got implemented out in Bears Ears, I think is a great way to do it. Five tribes are co-managing a national monument with the National Park Service. That's a huge thing. People need to advocate for things like that, for the return of lands, but it's also like, we need to start having like hiring preferences for park rangers and people in the jobs that are working on the land directly, and folks need to understand as a collective like why that's valuable and how that's not, you know, that's not a reverse racism, and it's also not like a it's like indigenous people, we're not just a race, you know, we are a unique political class because we belong to multiple nations, right? And so we have unique rights that come with it, and it's not a race thing so much nearly as it is about like a time-honored tradition and knowledge that has not been allowed to even be passed down through academia that still exists within our communities that needs to be proliferated in order for all of us to benefit from the environmental impacts of that. And so I think that's a really big thing, is understanding like land back and solutions for Indigenous people when it comes to ecology in particular are solutions for everybody. And with as severe as the climate crisis is, like, we don't have time to like do an experiment and figure out what's going to work. We need to understand that the stories, the traditions, and the cultures of Indigenous people hold thousands of years of science within them, right? And what is science? It's not just what's in a book somewhere in a university or a high school classroom or whatever. Science is human beings out there repeating the scientific method, right? Where we have a hypothesis and we test it through our actions. Well, that's what Indigenous people have been doing to live in balance with the places that we live for thousands of years. And so people need to trust us, see us as human beings, and not just value white knowledge within academia, but allow Indigenous people to implement climate solutions immediately for all of us.
I spend a lot of time in Colorado. I live in Utah now, but when I see all of the Colorado Native bumper stickers and stuff everywhere, right, I'm like, ah!
Like, yeah, it take just that feels off like your car.
Yeah, it feels like a slap in the face for like so many reasons, but especially what you're saying, like, there are people who have lived there for thousands and thousands of years and understand the land, and for, oh my gosh, that's just me ranting, but like,
no, but it's real. And it's like, if you take that word from us, like, we don't speak English, right? We don't call ourselves Native in our own languages. We call ourselves, you know, the Ute call themselves Nutu. As Lakota people, we call ourselves Lakota. And for so much of us, like, our names for what we call ourselves so often means like the people, the human beings. And I think that's an important thing to remember. And then so it's like, if you tell us that we're supposed to call ourselves Native, and then you take that by saying, I'm a Colorado Native, here's my bumper sticker on my car, well, then you took the word which you've given us for self-determination, right? We are already subjugated to the degree that we have to find a word in someone else's language to call ourselves by. And people are so eager to define themselves by that word that then it's taken from us, and what do we call ourselves? And so, yeah, I think it's a super valid thing. It's just like, people have to understand like what it is that we're actually experiencing. But as Native people, like, we got to close some of that gap ourselves, which is unfortunate. But I think of that a lot as somebody who had to work to re-educate myself and reclaim my culture. Like, nobody was going to do that for me. There was no school I could go to that was going to offer all that. And you got to remember, that's even more heightened for people who aren't Indigenous. Like, they know even less about that. And so, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a skier, so it's not my thing. And I'm not like super knowledgeable about the sport, but you are an amazing skier. Watching this film, there's like all these incredible shots of you just freaking flying down mountainsides, like you hike up to mountain peaks and are flying down them. I'm curious if there's ever, I'm sure there had, like, about moments where basically Mother Nature has just kicked your ass and have been like, and what that is like and how that affects some of these feelings of like what we have to do or your relationship with nature.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big thing for me that inspired wanting to make the film, is just like the place where we made it in the San Juans in Colorado is like one of the most avalanche prone places in the world, right? There's tons of avalanches here. The year that we, you know, made the film, there was, I think, like 7 or 9 avalanche fatalities just in the San Juans that year. And when you consider there's like 3 towns in the San Juans and like none of them are large towns, like, it's a lot of people. And so, yeah, I think like for me, like that understanding of like, you're out there with something that can take your life away. And that's a humbling thing. And for me, some of the most humbling things, like, I've had my fair share of experiences as a skier and as a runner and climbing mountains and things that are humbling. But for me, I go back to my Hamblecha, which as a Lakota person is like, one of, is our vision quest. And it's one of our, you know, most foremost like ceremonies. It goes back to our creation story. And it's simply the act of like, we translate it to like suffering for a vision. And so you fast for days without food and water, and you sit out on the land and you sing and you embrace that suffering. And so for me, I think that because of that culturally, like there's something ingrained in me all the time after having multiple Humblecha experiences where it's like, I know the power of simply not being able to eat or drink or to be stuck in one spot and you can't leave and you're experiencing the elements. And so like, yeah, that's a huge motivation in making this film, is just knowing like, I feel like there's a power to these places. I feel like there's like a consciousness to these mountains. There's a reason that, you know, indigenous people gave these mountains names that, you know, are names of relatives, you know? And so if these are relatives out there who are, you know, 14,000 feet tall, like I'm only 6'5", I think I'm going to defer to them, you know? And so I wanted to do something to make sure like I'm right with these places, and that like, as I'm experiencing a place, like I know the place is experiencing me as well as the guest. And so, yeah, I want my intentions out there to be right if I'm going to be with these beings who give and also take life.
So what role does filmmaking play in all this? So you're the subject of the film, but you're also the co-director. So how does that, where does that fit into your kind of life story and activism that you're doing by speaking about these things?
You know, like I've always been someone who is good at speaking and communicating an idea to people interpersonally, but I'm not like a good writer. I don't have a college education or any of those things. But for me, this film was kind of like a group process of turning like a vision and these spoken ideas that were shared between, you know, both like our indigenous filmmakers at Natives Outdoors and the production team that we worked with at Wonder Camp to kind of co-create this vision. And for me, I think like filmmaking is a really natural progression for indigenous people to move into telling our stories in that format, because we've always come from oral traditions, right? We come from carrying our culture in our songs, in our dances, and it maybe isn't the most accessible thing for us to always be expected to write our stories, for it to be in a news article or to be in a book. And it's not to say that those aren't super valid as well. Like I'm on here telling you to read books by indigenous authors. Mm-hmm. I think news by indigenous journalists is a great thing. But when you look at like, you know, what we're able to do this film, or like the success of shows like Reservation Dogs in the last year and things like that, it's like, okay, like clearly this is a more natural way, I think, for indigenous people to communicate our stories and to do it in such a way that like builds empathy and understanding of ourselves as human in the eyes of people who are potentially our allies and accomplices, and humanizes us as like contemporary people. Because I think that's a really important thing, is like when other people have told our stories, made films about Native people, it's so often like in the past, and that's not the reality for most of us. Like, you know, like there's no headdress in my closet, there's no war club, like it's a ski helmet, it's skis, like, and mm-hmm. So for me, like that's who I am. And I think the more people who understand like, okay, Native folks wanting their land back, that doesn't mean like we're gonna kick everybody else off and it's only the buffalo roam here again or whatever. It's like, no, like we could be here, we can manage a ski area if we want to, we can, like there's already indigenous owned ski areas. Like I think there's just so much like of a gap in the knowledge of like indigenous people in the past and indigenous people as contemporary people. And I think it's so much easier to understand that when you see it. You know, you see us listening to the music that you listen to, you see us skiing on the mountains that you're skiing on. Like I think that's a lot easier to understand than to just say, we're just like you in written words. Like anyone can do that. But when you see it portrayed in a story, I think that awakes like a different part of human compassion that I think is something, you know, we all need to be tapping into right now.
I'm curious, you gave the recommendation Braiding Sweetgrass, the book. You mentioned Reservation Dogs. Who are some other like contemporaries and colleagues in all areas that you are really looking up to or you recommend to other people to look into more?
I mean, I'll start with the folks closest to me. Len Nessifer, who founded Natives Outdoors, which is the indigenous owned and operated media and apparel company that I work for. He's an awesome guy to just have that vision of how to help Native folks beyond the nonprofit complex, and to find ways to like really give us our own sovereignty and authority to tell our stories. That's been an incredible thing. And that there's a lot of people doing similar things in spheres other than outdoor recreation. That just happens to be where we're focused. Alan Bradley, who is an indigenous biologist and skier as well. Isaiah Branch Boyle, who is the director of mountain cinematography on this film. He comes from white miners on one side of his family and indigenous people from the same mountain range on the other side of his family. Those kind of stories really inspire me, of the friends that you see like overcoming these colonial challenges in their own life. And then, branching out a little bit more, Jade Begay, who was on the panel with us, as part of NDN Collective, which is an incredible organization. They put together a book called Required Reading, which helps people understand how settler colonialism is responsible for climate change. I think that's a huge thing that most people will not understand unless an indigenous person is able to explain it to them. And then branching a little farther out, I really look up to the folks who make the shows like Res Dogs and Rutherford Falls, really inspired by folks like Dallas Goldtooth, who's a Lakota comedian. I love seeing us in those spaces that have so often throughout my life never been filled by a Native person. I never saw Native people on TV growing up unless they were the enemy in a headdress of a cowboy on TV. I think that is a huge shift for us to just represent ourselves as normal people. Love the book They're There by Tommy Orange. It's really an exploration of life for indigenous people who live in urban areas. And I think a lot of people don't understand that 80% of Natives live off the reservation in urban areas, rural areas across the rest of the country. Only 20% of the Native population is on the reservation residing there currently. And I think there's a narrative that exists that doesn't come from our community that says that's only where they are. And if you live in the city, you live in the suburbs, whatever, you're less Native. And I think it's really important for us as indigenous people to understand that that is a narrative created by someone else to silence and erase us. And so I love all the stories that transcend that. Because for me, I just identify with that so much more. And I think, activating those 80% of Native folks who, live in urban areas might not have the same access to learning their language or learning their cultural practices to inspire them to be nope, this can be a part of your urban life as well. Go to your elders, learn your language, learn your practices, and bring them to where you're at, because the city is still stolen Native land the same way that the mountains or, any other place are. So
that was a great group of people and recommendations. I love They're There. I read it I think last summer, and I want to read it again. That was a book that just really stuck with me. It's so well written, and it's just really accessible. It's an easy read, but but it's great. And I have another episode for anyone listening with Sterling Harjo, if you haven't heard that yet. Right before,
I need to go listen. Yeah, to that. Yeah. Okay.
He talks about when he was starting to make Reservation Dogs on the episode, but he hadn't gotten to it yet, so it's exciting. And Jade Begay and I were on another podcast episode together called Wampum Codes, Wampum.codes. It was a episode we did through MIT for, I think we were talking about Natives in tech in different ways. And I was talking about telling Native stories through film festivals. But she's awesome. For anyone listening, you should follow Jade Begay on social media. She's one of my favorite people to follow. She offers a lot of solutions to the climate crisis that we're in, a lot of political action, and also like a lot of really relaxing content as well to like give yourself a break. So I highly recommend following her. But to finish us off, how do people follow you and see the film? And also you had talked about, I wanted you to talk about, you said a grant program or something like that, that you run.
Oh yeah. The scholarship program.
Yeah. Scholarship program.
Yeah. 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 So I run, with the help of Ellen Bradley and other folks at Natives Outdoors, the Natives Outdoors Icon Pass Scholarship. And so we give away the Icon Pass, which allows Native folks to access skiing at mountains across Turtle Island in the U.S. and Canada, and hooks them up also with all the outerwear, snowboard or skis, boots, helmets, goggles, all the things, as well as lessons, and just empowers Indigenous folks to get back on the land, but to do it in a new way. And that's something that for me has been a really healing thing. And so I figured, you know, if there's me right now who's able to make an impact because of the relationship I built through skiing, how do I make that available to 10 more people every year? And so that's what we're working on, and, you know, looking for ways to expand it. We also use the proceeds from the film to empower the Ute Mountain Ute Tribes Tribal Recreation Department to get out and be able to go ski as well. So that's been, you know, a really awesome thing. And able to do it all kind of on the back of Spirit of the Peaks, which is available online for free. It's on YouTube. You just type in Spirit of the Peaks. It'll be the first thing that comes up. And then for me personally, if folks want to follow along with me, I'm on Instagram, Sacred Stoke, all one word like that. And, you know, follow along with Natives Outdoors as well. And we've got a whole team of really rad ambassadors and athletes and filmmakers, and yeah, there's a lot of us from a lot of different tribes coming together to show up and tell the stories of our community, and to present outdoor recreation and these sports in a way that can be a bridge for all of us to have better relations with the native land that we're on.
Awesome. Thank you, Connor. This has been really inspiring. And when I got to see you speak on that panel, I was so excited to get to talk with you one-on-one. So thank you so much. This has been, it's inspiring for me personally. And I, you know, feel more or less connected, but I'm excited for other people who are kind of starting their journey with like learning about having reciprocity with the land and learning about reconnecting with their culture, to really like hear, like see your film and hear about your story, because I think that can help a lot of people.
Absolutely. Yeah, I really appreciate the invite, and that's an awesome conversation.
Thank you guys for listening to this episode of Faux Real. You can find Spirit of the Peaks for free on YouTube, and you can follow Connor Ryan on Instagram at Sacred Stoke. Thank you to Mountain Film for introducing Spirit of the Peaks to me and Connor Ryan. If you haven't heard of that film fest before, I highly recommend it. It's really awesome, and it takes place in Telluride every Memorial Day weekend. The music for this podcast is Lost and Bound by Talene Cully, and she's going to be going on tour soon, so check that out at Talene Cully. The artwork is by Whitney Salgado, and I'm your host, Dawn Borchardt.